Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
Tonight on Primetime Politics, Justin Trudeau at the Foreign Interference Inquiry.
If we say certain things, or if we contradict or deny other things, we could be giving our adversaries tools.
What did the Prime Minister know about foreign meddling in the 2019 and 2021 votes? How did he respond to those allegations? We'll go through what we heard today at the Ho Commission. Also, the federal budget is a week away, but the government has already unveiled some key details. Our political panel will tell us what those announcements say about government priorities as they lag in the polls. And the U.S. ambassador shares his thoughts on the newly released defense policy for Canadian forces. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. We begin tonight with the public inquiry into foreign interference, the Ho Commission hearing from senior government ministers today, answering questions about what and when they knew about allegations of foreign meddling in the last two federal elections. The Prime Minister was the last to take the stand this afternoon and defended his response to security concerns.
Hadn't been something that the previous government or any previous government had done much on at all. So we started from a standing start. We created the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians. We created NSERA. We moved forward to the Rapid Response Mechanism, and we've continued to do more. Yes, the panel for the 2019 and 2021 elections site, but we've continued to do more.
Well, Stephen Chase is a senior parliamentary reporter for the Globe and Mail. He has been one of the paper's lead reporters on the foreign interference file. Steve, thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, glad to be here.
Listen, of course, one of the big questions here is whether or not the government dropped the ball or if the process itself is flawed. You know, after listening today and throughout this public part of the inquiry, what can you say about that?
One of the things that's become clear is that when they conceived of ways to protect Canadians from interference, from foreign interference, they really had Russia in mind. All the examples they cited, they've been looking at Russian disinformation. And so they set up a lot of the things that they set up, a lot of the mechanisms, really thinking about what Moscow would do, and very little sense that China was going to be, in fact, the foremost aggressor, as CSIS has subsequently told us. Also, we got a sense here that a real sense from them that they are trying to make the case that they weren't given all the warnings that we now know. In fact, we had this almost ludicrous example yesterday where a briefing note to the PMO contained key conclusions about China, you know, clandestinely interfering in the 2019 and 2021 elections. And then we had the deputy chief of staff to the prime minister saying the day later, we never got that, so they didn't tell us that.
Yeah,
and so there's a sense also they're trying to blame the messengers.
Well, let's pick up on that point, because you did point out when you were speaking with my producer a big discrepancy from what we heard from the PM's chief of staff last year and what the prime minister was testifying to today. Can you walk us through what stood out for you?
Sure. Obviously, one of the big questions is what did the PM know and when did he know it, and did they do enough to protect Canadians from Chinese foreign interference? In particular, last year, April 2023, at a committee, Chief of Staff Katie Telford insisted to MPs that the Prime Minister reads everything that's put before him, reads all the documents. Today, however, the Prime Minister had a different story, both in a pre-interview testimony that was given to us as well as his live testimony today. And in fact, he doesn't rely on reading documents. If he doesn't read them, he relies on the National Security and Intelligence Advisor to tell him. And in fact, he says, if you have something important to tell me, you have to deliver it to me orally. So a real discrepancy in terms of what he knew and how much he was told.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the public portion of these hearings, they were meant to wrap up today, but they've now been extended to allow more questions to be asked of the CSIS director on Friday. I'm wondering, as you continue to cover this story, what questions still linger for you? Because, of course, the work of this inquiry is far from over.
I think that, first of all, they're bringing back the CSIS director on Friday in order to address this very issue of all these briefing notes to the PMO, which have him making allegedly making dire warnings to them. But then the PMO staff yesterday telling us they never heard that. So that's why he's being called back. But one of the questions I have is whether we're going to eventually come up with a more substantive conclusion than what David Johnson gave us, which was that people seem to have tried their best. And there were some communication problems, but really there was nothing to worry about. We have already, in the space of 10 days of hearings, 11 days of hearings, learned a lot more. We've had access to a lot more intelligence, a lot more, you know, secret information about what happened. And I'm hoping that they'll put this together in a narrative that will explain to Canadians what really happened.
Well, we continue to watch all of it. And Stephen, between now and our next conversation, thank you. We'll speak again because, as I said, you've been one of the lead reporters on this file. So thank you for the time tonight.
You're welcome.
Well, let's continue our conversation about the Hogue Commission. Joining us right now are Susan Smith, principal with the Blue Sky Strategy Group, Josie Sabatino, senior consultant with Summa Strategies, and Anne McGrath, principal secretary to the NDP leader. Hello to the three of you.
Hello.
So I don't know how unfair this is, but I do want to begin with the Hogue Commission, because, you know, when we go through what has emerged, at least this week, in broad strokes, the fact that senior Liberals were informed, not necessarily the Prime Minister, the fact that the PMO official said that CSIS never told them to get rid of their candidate in the Don Valley North riding of Toronto back in 2019, and that with both 2019 and 2021, the panel of bureaucrats monitoring threats against those two elections essentially said that the meddling did not affect the democratic process, nor did they merit a public alert. Add to that what you will, and I know this gets a little bit of ahead of what the Commission is doing right now, but when you listen to the testimony, and you were involved in testimony, does it point to the need for a different process of monitoring potential interference and how that is shared with the political parties?
I think so, and hindsight is definitely 2020 on this. The world has changed. I mean, we've got deep fakes. We are now truly aware that there is election potential for election meddling at a level that there didn't used to be, I don't think. And the fact that it can be so granular without it being completely evident to people. So I think they do need to look at a new process, simply because the way people might choose to meddle has also evolved. So I think that only is responsible in it to preserve the democracy.
Now, of course, the Conservative Party raised a number of issues with how they felt the information was dealt with and what was shared or not shared with them. What do you say to the process, Josie?
Well, I think if you're an average Canadian watching what's happening, you can reasonably put together that the reason we're having this public inquiry in the first place is because the public threshold was so high for getting this information. And it was a result of the efforts of whistleblowers and the media to really put a spotlight on this issue and bring it forward. And here we are more than a year later, and we're now learning who knew what and when. So I really do think that we need to look at that public threshold and make a decision, because everybody acknowledges that foreign interference was in the public domain in the 2019 and 2021 election.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what do you say? Now, again, you testified before the commission.
Yes, I did. The three main political parties testified about what they knew and what they didn't know. I think what we're discovering is, number one, it absolutely was essential to have the public inquiry. I think that everybody, you know, when the special rapporteur said that there was no need for a public inquiry, there was a bit of an outcry, and I think that was legit, because I think it's obvious that we needed a public inquiry. I think that it's becoming clear that people who had information that they should have passed on were not passing that information on, and certainly we made recommendations both when we met with the special rapporteur and in this process about how political parties should be informed and how they should be brought in and those kinds of things. I think that the threshold for a public alert, I'm interested to see where that goes, because there are downsides to that as well, having a lower threshold. But I think we're discovering that people needed to know things when there were concerns that the security officials had. I think that we're discovering that some of what was going on was riding level specific, and it seems very clear that they were really just looking at the whole picture. And I think you do have to get a little bit more granular. And of course, I'll be very interested to see what the Prime Minister's testimony is, because I think we do need to know if what he knew and what he did about what he knew.
Yeah, and to be clear for people at home, at the time of this recording, the Prime Minister has not yet spoken, although we will have that in the program tonight. You were going to say something.
The other overlay is that it was a COVID election in 2021. We'd never done an election in a global pandemic before. And I think it's possible that foreign actors took advantage of the fragmentation of the electoral process in this particular case. People were not getting together in big rooms, having big conversations, working in war rooms on the size and scale that they used to. And so it might have been difficult, even perhaps for the security folks, I don't know, to add up one plus one plus one to get three, because maybe it wasn't looking like that at all. But we're back to a regular election cycle going forward. The technology and tools for foreign actors has changed. And it's clear that people in all political parties need to know in a timely manner real, credible issues. And it came out in some of the testimony this week from Katie Telford that one of the things that had been put forward turned out to be wrong, that the officials had been putting forward. So you can't have a knee-jerk reaction to these things. It's very important. But I do think any responsible democracy continues to evolve its processes for this, because there are irresponsible global actors that want to take shots at our democracy.
Mm-hmm. And did you want one more to respond to that at all?
I think we really need to know what these recommendations are going to be that come out next month. That is where the real work starts. And this testimony was critical to finding out where the gaps are. And again, who knew what when. And we really need those recommendations to lay the foundation for the roadmap that leads into the next election.
Mm-hmm. And
yes, I want to go back to the COVID thing. When I think about the 2021 campaign, the primary issue was how to run a campaign during COVID. And that was what we were mostly preoccupied. I would not say that foreign interference was high on anybody's radar. And that's been clear from all of the testimony so far. But I think that the recommendations will be very important, because I agree that going forward, we now know a lot more than we did. And we need to make sure that we get the information that we need, and that we know once we get the information, we know what to do with it in a responsible way.
Well, and to add to that, one interesting aspect was with 2019, the concern was about Russia, and we're really talking about China now and how it attempted to, according to CSIS, interfere in the election process. So we'll keep monitoring that. The public
portion. I would say even broader than that.
Yes.
North Korea.
Absolutely. 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 And, you know, we'll say that the public portion has been extended. It was supposed to end today. It's been extended to allow another questioning of the CSIS director on Friday. So we'll watch for that. But listen, let's move on to the budget. Of course, the federal budget next week. But already we're getting some big announcements, and have been ever since the budget day was announced. What does it say to you when you hear what has been announced and what's been prioritized by this government? What does it say to you about the cohorts that they're trying to appeal to as they look at a potential election down the road, sooner rather than later, and also still lagging very much in the polls?
Yeah, so as someone who's been a kind of a communications or public relations practitioner for 30 years, practically, I think it's a very clever tactic that the Liberals are doing right now. Budgets notoriously are big tomes that land on desks. Nerds like us get very excited and we look at things in them. But you know, it's long been said that it's a good budget if it's fish wrap the next day, right? And so in this case, the Liberals are optimizing their announcements. They've made 10, five of which are related to housing. And to your question, they're targeting millennials, Gen Zers, and their parents and grandparents who have the concerns that this generation feels they have. I think the Liberals are trying to bring these group of voters back into the fold. There's no question. Additional announcements were school food programs and mental health issues and more childcare spaces. So they're aiming squarely at the affordability concerns that Canadians are feeling. And by rolling out these announcements kind of one at a time, they're able to grab some time in the news cycle and give people an opportunity to digest them, rather than in the middle of their busy lives trying to wade through a 500-page document or just deal with the headlines and whatever the newspaper tells them is important.
At 4:30 in the afternoon. What do you say to that, Josie?
I think affordability is on the minds of every Canadian right now, but when I think about the cohort that the Liberals are trying to target with a lot of these announcements, I have to think that millions of high school-age kids are graduating, millions of college student kids around Canada are going to be graduating and making decisions about, you know, where they rent and what their future looks like. And I think there is a lot of anxiety that comes with the Gen Z and millennial group of voters. And that is really where the Liberals, I think, are trying to get back on track. They're trying to make housing a priority. And I think that is coming through in a lot of the announcements they're making. But, you know, the devil is always in the details with these budgets. And we also have to be mindful of how these spending promises are being paid for. And I think that's where we'll see the Conservatives really lead in come budget day.
Yes, so we'll look at the numbers. Certainly with the fall economic statement, that was a big question as to the amount of being spent and the proportion of the budget of that. But also interesting to hear the Prime Minister basically say, you know, we feel your pain, your anger is legitimate. And what do you say about these announcements ahead of the budget itself?
Well, I agree that it's a good way to do it. It's not new. I mean, it's been done in several provinces before. It's been done, I think it's even been done federally before. It makes sense in that way, because it does give you the opportunity to present a kind of a thematic approach to it and identify who your audience is. And I agree that it is millennials and Gen Z and the people that care about those particular cohorts. So I think it's a smart. There's going to have to be things in the budget itself, too, that have not been rolled out. So I'll be very interested to see if people have been, you know, lulled into a sense of complacency and think, oh, well, everything's out there, and not really pay attention to whatever tome we get on Tuesday. I think that's going to be important to pay close attention to as well.
Yeah.
And I think I personally believe that the revenue side is an issue. I think I'd have a different approach to it than the Conservatives, but I do think that it's not just about, a budget can't be just about spending, it also has to be about revenue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were going to jump in on that.
I was going to say, much of what you're hearing now is appeal at their kitchen table, the kitchen table components of the budget. There will be the detail in the big document when it comes, where the technical stuff, where the input tax credits or the innovation tax credits that have been talked about, the technical things that companies are looking for, you'll see, I think, more. That's where the meat of that is, and always in the tables in the back of the books in the budget. But definitely there'll be more that will come. But I think the Prime Minister, the Finance Minister, and all of Cabinet, I mean, they're doing a good job getting to the corners of the country as well as the big cities, are setting the table to say to people, we have been listening, we have been hearing from you, we understand housing, for example, is a primary issue. So I think people, it would be hard to say you'd missed it or you didn't know or there was nothing happening in this particular case, whereas if they waited till budget day to drop it all, there would be lots of people to say, well, I didn't hear about it. In this case, by rolling it out over a two-week period, I think there's an opportunity there for people, for it to register.
Does it present an opportunity for opposition parties, though, to also form their counterpoints to what is going to be in the budget?
Absolutely. And we've seen Pierre Poilievre going on this carbon tax tirade. And any mention of new taxes in the budget, that will just set him off and his party. And I think we'll see more and more focus on the economy if those deficits point to a large number in the budget. So those are the two points that the Conservatives are really going to be laser focused on. The third part of this is if the Liberals are going to point to growth as, you know, an area where they really want to focus the economy, people need details at this point. And I don't think they're going to be able to get away with top line talking points on the issue any longer.
Okay, last word to you.
Well, I mean, the budget is a really important document. It is, you know, people say, you show me your budget and I'll show you your priorities, right? It has to be a priority setting thing. So I think that it's being targeted at, I think, the right kind of, the right people, because, you know, you're right. There's no one in this country that isn't worried about affordability, mm-hmm. but there are some people who are doing very, very well and some companies that are doing very, very well. And I do think that there needs to be a bit of a rebalancing. I think that, you know, when people look at groceries and the amount that's being brought in by the CEOs of the grocery stores and by the companies themselves, there are questions about fairness and about equality. And so I think ability to pay for these programs has to also land on the wealthy CEOs.
Okay. Well, of course, we'll be watching Budget Day. But for now, Anne, Susan, Josie, thank you very much for
Thanks.
The time.
Thanks so much.
Well, the government's newly released defense policy is getting some positive reaction from Canada's allies. As you may remember, on Monday, the Trudeau government committed $8.1 billion over the next 5 years to invest in national defense. Over 20 years, it will be $73 billion that will be invested, money to be earmarked for equipment and recruitment as climate change creates a security challenge in Canada's north and as authoritarian regimes challenge the international rules-based order. Well, for some reaction to the defense policy unveiled this week, we're now joined by the U.S. Ambassador to Canada, David Cohen. Ambassador Cohen, good to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on your air. It's good to see you again as well.
Well, I enjoy our conversation, so I'm happy you're here because, you know, I do want to begin with your reaction, with your thoughts, on the defense policy announced this week, because in the past, the United States has, perhaps more behind closed doors than out in public, been critical of Canada's defense policies and spending. What's your reaction to what you saw this week?
Well, we welcome the defense policy update, and we are heartened by it. And frankly, I think it is very consistent with the way in which we have approached Canada's defense spending, which is that you can't measure Canada's commitment to defense by reference to any single metric. You have to look at a larger package of things like the trajectory of spend. But most importantly, what we're interested in Canada as a partner in defense is Canada's ability to respond to threat levels in the current environment and its ability to position itself to be responsive when it needs to step up in the defense area. And the defense policy update, we believe, really hits those points very strongly. Its emphasis on the Arctic, its emphasis on continental defense, its commitment to additional spending, which Minister Blair has privately and publicly said that he knows Canada needs to do. When you talk, I've seen $8 billion over the first 5 years, that's not very much money. But $72 billion, $73 billion over 20 years, moving the percentage of Canada's GDP that's spent on defense from 1.33 to 1.76 by 2029 or 2030. That's a significant move. And I think the spending that is firmly committed in the defense policy update is the largest increase in defense spending in Canada, certainly in recent memory and maybe in history. And again, what's been described to us is it does not get to 2% of GDP, but it's a significant and substantial down payment on getting to 2% of GDP. And there's a commitment to continue to invest elsewhere. One of the things I like about the policy is, first of all, there's an actual defense strategy embedded in the policy, and that's something that's been missing in Canada. And second of all, the commitment to revisit the defense policy every 4 years, which is exactly the kind of refresher that we think is appropriate and necessary, as opposed to waiting every 7 or 8 years to revisit spending in the defense area.
Well, you mentioned metrics, and as you point out, even with all this spending, Canada will not meet the 2% of GDP NATO target. Given that Canada is such a key player in continental defense alongside with the United States, is that still bothersome, though, that Canada's not reaching the 2%?
Well, I do think, and I always want to be careful, because Canada is a sovereign nation. They need to have the room to make their own decisions. The 2% is not something that the United States or the UK or the rest of NATO imposed on Canada. It is a spending level that Canada voluntarily agreed to at the original Wales commitments, renewed its commitment to it in the Vilnius conference last year, and reaffirmed its commitment to spend 2% of its GDP on defense during the president's visit. So I do think that, among other factors, bringing your defense spending to a point where it represents at least 2% of GDP is something that is worth striving for and worth doing. What I'm focusing on here is that Canada, for the first time, seems to have a plan to get to 2%, certainly making a very substantial down payment on that in the defense policy update, and flagging areas of additional commitment that it is interested in. And again, my focus and the United States' focus is on Canada's ability to respond to the threat environment as it exists to do. And we do have a special interest in working together with Canada on continental defense and the Arctic. And the defense policy update contains a whole series of commitments, whether it's ground sensors and a greater number of forward operating stations in the Arctic and investments in helicopters and aircraft for domain awareness, on top of the commitments Canada's made in its NORAD modernization strategy of over-the-horizon radar and building infrastructure that will be able to handle the F-35s and the additional military capacity that will be delivered in the Arctic to Canada over the next 5 to 7 years. So you take that all together, we do have a high level of comfort in Canada as a partner and the commitments that Canada has made and its ability to respond to the threat levels that we are most concerned about.
Quickly running out of time, but I do want to ask you, because the next NATO summit will be hosted by Washington this summer. We talked earlier this week in a separate event about the 75th anniversary of NATO. When you look at Canada and the United States, how important is this relationship and the kind of example it sets for the world in terms of democracies working together hand in hand to protect what has been built?
So I think this is one of the most important elements of the relationship between Canada and the United States. As the President has said, when Canada and the United States work together, we make a big difference. It gets noticed. And when you talk about support of NATO and support of Ukraine and support in the Indo-Pacific and support in the Arctic, it's about, and support on the world stage, it has to be about more than defense spending. It's about leadership of values. So, you know, Canada's played an extraordinary role globally in terms of leadership against arbitrary detention. Canada was the author and the prime sponsor of the Declaration Against Arbitrary Detention. It's done most of the work in generating the dozens and dozens of countries who've signed on to that. When Canada and the United States speak together on the horrific behavior by Russia in invading, horrific and illegal behavior by Russia in invading Ukraine, we speak louder and in a more compelling fashion by speaking together. So this partnership between the United States and Canada is extremely important. It's extremely valuable. It's been extremely effective, and it will continue to play that role.
Ambassador David Cohen, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you again for having me.
And that is our program for this Wednesday. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. I'm Michael Serapio. Primetime Politics will be back tomorrow, but up next, L'Essentiel avec Omaira Issa.